we get into today's podcast, I've got an invitation for you. We're about to kick off the sixth edition of our most popular program, The Neuroscience of Change. This training is based on what revolutionary research in neuroscience has revealed about transformational coaching, essentially showing us what works, what doesn't, and why. In the program, you'll learn what happens in the brain and body when different coaching techniques are used, how to guide your clients into positive learning states that allow genuine change to occur, and why some tried and true coaching methods actually inhibit change and what we can do instead. We created this course because I learned things from the lead teacher, Amanda Blake, that truly revolutionized the way I coach. And every year, she and all the teachers bring in new, cutting-edge science that continues to illuminate the process of transformation. Amanda will be joined by the rest of our world-class faculty of coaches and neuroscientists for this program, including Dan Siegel, Alan Fogel, Claire Dale, David Trelevin, and Richard Boyatzis. It's going to be an amazing, transformative journey, so I hope you'll come and join us. You can head to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. The first class is February 25th, 2025 with Amanda Blake. And if you sign up by February the 7th, you can get the early bird discount. So just go to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. So yeah, I'm delighted to be with you today, Boyd. I'm going to introduce you in a moment, but first of all, just let me check how you're doing in this moment.
Oh, I'm just really excited to be here with you. I'm looking out of my office window from Londolozi Game Reserve in South Africa, and I can see some elephants in the river. And yeah, excited to feel this energy traveling out to all of your community, and hopefully there'll be some nuggets for some practitioners of the transformational arts.
Yeah, I'm sure there will. I just want to say you did a masterclass for us earlier this year, and I've never done one and had so much feedback from people afterwards who were touched by. Yeah, it was electric, and people were really touched by it. So we're going to get, I think, into some of the same areas, but also some different areas. Let me just introduce you a little bit. So I'll just say this. You're a wildlife and literary activist, and you've spent the last 10 years refining refining the art of using wilderness as a place for deep introspection and personal transformation. And I just listened to Story Hunters, your podcast. I really recommend that. And you describe yourself as an artist of experience and having a passion to create transformational experiences. So as you just named, you're in South Africa. You grew up on the Londolozi Game Reserve, a former hunting ground that your father transformed into a nature reserve. And since childhood, you've been sharing your home with lions, leopards, snakes, and elephants. And you've trained as a tracker, and you're applying the principles of tracking to tracking our lives. And you teach others about this. And maybe actually I should have invited you to do the podcast to introduce yourself. The last thing I'll say is you're the author of two books, The Lion Tracker's Guide to Life, which I can't recommend highly enough to people, and the memoir you wrote, The Cathedral of the Wild. So yeah, there we go. That was my first practice at like introducing someone inside the podcast, because I've been doing it for so long outside.
Thank you. That's a nice little cover story, you know, the stories we tell about ourselves. But that gives people a bit of a sense. Thank you.
Cheers. I just want to ask you, actually, I'm sure we'll get into your life, your upbringing, and how that's influenced the work you do as a coach and the transformational work you do. But before we do that, or maybe you weave the answer that into this answer, how is your work a response right now to the world we find, you know, the state of the world, really? Do you find your work is adapting, or maybe it just is a response, really, to the way the world is? Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's good that those questions come together, because I would say that where I come from and the way that my work is evolved is intricately tied together. And, you know, as a young boy, I watched my parents restoring this former bankrupt cattle farm into its former wild glory. And so the things that went into my young psyche were micro catchments being restored on the land, and where scrub had overrun the land being cleared away so that grasslands could return, and animals starting to return where previously they had been hunted. And so that those images of a relationship being rebuilt with nature went into me very deeply and almost unconsciously. And then later in my life, when I met my first teacher and I started being introduced to the transformational arts, I started to see that the transformation of individual consciousness was profoundly linked to the restoration of the world. And I mean the restoration of the wilderness and human relationship with nature. And if a person was very fragmented and traumatized and far away from themselves, it's very, very difficult to have a relationship with nature, and very difficult for them to be attuned to the infinite gifts that can come out of the natural world. And so I started to see how those two things went together. And I also started to see that if you could help a person heal back towards wholeness, if you could help a person become more in tune with themselves, almost inevitably, a person who is entering into wholeness starts to emit and take on certain characteristics. One is almost always there is a longing for a more simple life. There is a yearning to be quiet and to be in nature more. There's a desire to be of service. There's the stirrings of a current to be creative. There is a sense that the status quo of how we're told to live our lives is perhaps not taking us where we want to go. And there's this desire to be in service of something greater. And I almost inevitably, and anyone who I've worked with who has experienced some kind of healing, the versions of that start to emerge. And the biggest thing I see is that when someone really heals, what comes into them is an unbelievable sense of enough, you know, and that manifests usually as I am enough. I can really breathe out into that. And I have enough. In a culture that is always telling us there's not enough scarcity. And if we consume these things, then we'll feel safe. If we get more stuff, then we'll be able to say, I'm worthy. But that's really, I've come to see as an inside job. And so I believe that when people heal, they come into enoughness, they stop needing to deeply participate in consumer culture. And I'd see that what they want to do and contribute changes naturally. And so I work with people for nature, in some ways.
Yeah, beautiful. And we could get more into the coaching, how maybe like the coaching moves you make can afford that kind of healing and that kind of orientation towards wholeness. What do you think are the opportunities with nature for that? Like, what role do you think nature can play in that healing process? And like, how has it done that for you, really, and maybe your clients as well?
Well, I would say that if one of the things about the natural world is there's no verbal mind. When you're with the animals, when you're with the trees, what you experience is they're not telling a story about past and future. And so they start to naturally pull you into presence. And that presence is at the center of coaching because without it, it's very hard to fully feel your feelings. To be in tune with the somatic way that your body wants to talk to you, to be able to have an awareness in which you can watch your mind and realize you're not that, a quietness. And then deeper things, I think when you put your attention on living things, more aliveness comes into your body. It's almost like if you focus on vitality, livingness, living creatures, that comes into you. If you focus on tech, you become more technological. I would also say that when you're in nature, you are starting to inevitably, two things start to happen. The one is you start to see a rich, intricate interconnectedness. Like as I look out my window now, I can see a monkey and he's running through the trees. And they're not separate, the tree and the monkey. The tree and the monkey evolve together. They live together, they rely on each other. The tree provides safety. The monkey distributes seed pods and fruits. So when I look at them, I see that interconnectedness. And so nature starts to pull you there. And then the final thing is, you know, often to a curious mind, the first thing is to try and know nature. You know, what is that tree? What bird is that? Where are those animals going? But with time, what starts to happen is there's some kind of transformation in which you stop needing to know nature. And when you enter into nature, rather what comes is an incredible feeling of being known. And that feeling is so different to what we find in a consumerist culture where the experience is almost always a feeling of isolation and otherness and comparison. In nature, you feel relationality. And inside of that relationality, as you start to feel, I belong here, I'm known here, something different can start to take root in you. So this is sort of the language that I've made around these experiences that I've had. And now my work is to try and be a conduit of the experiences that I've had for other people.
I'm feel a lot of excitement that you talk about this. It's been a big theme in my life and in the podcast. One of the things we've been exploring is like how has coaching become based on a lot of the worldview that it was born out of, like the modernity, the worldview of modernity, and how that's often based in this sense of hyper individualism and mechanistic kind of worldview of parts and separateness. And so a big theme has been around the recognition of our relationality as being actually like a fundamental, if not primary, part of who we are. And then that word aliveness, you know, the what actually starts to come in. And so I find it fascinating that you're also pointing to this too. And it makes me think about the evolution of the field itself. And you know, in a way, a lot of coaching has been based on the individual being successful. And there's not, you know, necessarily something wrong with that, but maybe it's been missing. The bit that's been missing is this part you're talking about, being known, the receptivity, the relationality, and what that brings forth in us.
I mean, for sure. And you know, there's a joke amongst coaches that when you really, especially in business coaching, right? That when you really start to make progress with your clients, the problem is they leave the job they're in, you know? So that's kind of well known. And what that points to is that, yes, I'm totally with you. Sometimes, you know, we're in a business coaching setting, we are trying to improve performance and develop new skills for communicating and being more direct or being able to, like, you're developing the skill set, but underneath it all, if the work is really taking root, then what ha is happening is that self-knowledge is growing, awareness is growing. And when awareness is growing, inevitably a sense of your own integrity, anywhere where you're crossing your own integrity will start to emerge. If you do something that is the right business move, but is counter to the awareness of your spirit, it starts to cut. And so, I mean, it's fun for me to see how coaching is evolving, right? But I think all coaching, when it really starts to take root and it stops being mechanical tools and strategies to be a better me, when you move through that level of it, which is an important level, inevitably, something more akin to being in tune with the wisdom of your own knowing starts to take root. And that can make you very effective and very optimized, but it will also inevitably take you into a different level of relationality with yourself and the world. So I almost think of it as there are of stages of consciousness within it, and all of them are important. And none is better than the other. They're just like it just It happens when you start being serious about using the tools of transformation and coaching. At some point, you're going to stop believing your own thoughts, and you're going to start to realize that your image of yourself is a constructed story, and some of it is valuable, and some of it is just old stories you've been telling. And when that starts to happen, awareness has to follow, and that awareness when it starts to take root is where major life transformations happen. So I think that it's an inevitable sliding scale of the work. I don't know. Maybe like hardcore business coaches would disagree with me.
Yeah, interesting. I agree with you. And so maybe then we can ask about your work in terms of how can we contract this this inner knowing, this wisdom, this knowing that you talked about. And then this is where you could refer to maybe what you've learned from tracking. So you might want to let us know about your upbringing a little bit.
Yeah, so what happened for me is that I was working as a safari guide, and I grew up tracking animals, being apprenticed by Shangaan trackers. And at that time, I thought that I was learning the art form of following an animal across a wild landscape, which is a beautiful art form because it's challenging and it's complicated, and you have to teach yourself to be attuned to these very specific signs. And to watch good trackers, it's like they're doing something magical. You won't believe what they're picking up on the ground. And they're telling the story as they move through the wilderness on the trail of this animal. So that's what I thought I was doing. I worked as a safari guide. And then when I was 23, I had been through a series of very difficult challenges, and I was quite traumatized and I was quite depressed. And I met my first mentor, who was Dr. Martha Beck. And Martha was a master and remains a master of transformational arts. And she, what happened was she actually came on safari and I took her tracking. And we found ourselves tracking a rhino. And at the end of the trail, she looked at me and she said to me, "You know, you and me do the same thing. What I've watched you do, I help people do in their own lives. And I teach them to track in their own lives." And it was like someone had switched the lights on for me. It just like it illuminated. And over the next 15 years, I developed a program which combined the art and the mentality of the tracker with transformational processes. And I start to find these incredible parallels. So, for example, if you want to go and track an animal, just like if you want to change your life, you have to be willing to not know. Almost all big transformations begin with saying, I actually don't know how to do this, and I don't know what this transform where this transformation goes. I just feel I'm stuck, I'm dull inside, or there's been some big catalytic event in my life and I'm a bit lost. I used to be the CEO, now I'm not that anymore. I used to be a parent, now the kids have left the home. I used to be married, now my spouse has divorced me. Whatever it is, we either get catalyzed into change, or we feel stuck and brittle. And when we know it's time to change, one of the things is we know it. The feeling of stuck is almost one of the indicators, but we don't know to what. Just like a tracker, all tracking, all transformation begins with not knowing. Then you have to attune, and you have to teach yourself to start to attune to this very interesting and unique set of tracks. And they'll be unique to you. And one of the ways you'll know what your track is it will literally feel like aliveness. And you will feel energy in your body when something or someone, I always say people, places, experiences, actions, when you think about doing those things and you feel aliveness in your body, you know that that has something to do with me. But you will have to teach yourself what does that. And what's incredible is when people surrender into not knowing and they just start to notice what actually gives them energy, it's incredible what they start to realize. Oh, something inside of me is drawn to that. My track knows to go there. Then, like a tracker, if you imagine we were out tracking a lion, what the trackers do is they work on what they call the first track. And so in an infinite wilderness, they are able to see the first track, then the next first track, then the next first track, then the next first track. And they dial down like infinite possibilities of where a wild animal could be going into a single moment of presence. I know to do this. I know to do this next. And so then you're going to have to learn to work with the first track. And it's really quite amazing how, when we start taking small micro steps towards what feels a little more essential, towards what feels like there's a little more energy and aliveness there, And we do that daily. It starts to take our life into really radical places. I'm actually a big proponent for small, like 1% betters every day, one step every day, as opposed to just like the old blow your life up and see what happens model, which is also can be fun and intense. But like a tracker, you learn to work on the first track. If you do that, you'll probably find yourself at some stage out in the wilderness, you know, literally in the metaphorical wilderness, the dark night of the soul, where who you once were is gone and who you are yet to be is not established. You're in the transformational tension. And quite often, right at that point, you lose all the tracks. And it's important for all people who go tracking to know that losing the tracks is part of tracking. And it's important to know that because otherwise you'll bail on yourself. You'll be too afraid and you'll go back to what was known. But if you have prepared yourself with the mentality of a tracker to say, yeah, that's okay, losing the track's part of it. I just go back to the system, not knowing, attuning, moving towards aliveness, trying things, being willing to be curious and playful. That's how you get back onto the track. And so those were just some of the principles that I started using. And what I noticed is that when people said to themselves, I don't know, and I'm tracking, incredible things started to happen. It's almost like on some deep unconscious level, when you have the courage to let go of one thing, sit in the transformational tension, but to sit in it with awareness, not to sit in it in frozen fear, to sit in it and say, I don't know, but I'm tuned, I'm switched on. There's a wild life out there, and inside of me are the tracks to take me to that wild life. It has been 100% incredible to me how that wildlife shows up if people are willing to do that. It starts to come. And you know what? It's work, and we call it the work because it's work. But that's how you do it. You start to step into the role of being a tracker. I would say that along the way, you should probably try and get some other great trackers around you, which is why I think your community is so fantastic. Because when you're doing transformational work, if you find yourself out there in that wilderness alone and you've lost the tracks, and other people are selling you all of their fears about what's possible and not possible in life, it can stunt you. You need to be around people who are saying, it's okay, we track together, we figure this out, let's try things, it's going to be okay. You need a community that has transformed, people around you who've been through reps of change who can cheerlead. So that's the mentality of the tracker. Then I would say within that, critically, you must be able to read the way your body talks to you. I think it has to be that you know how your body says that's energizing, how your body says yes. And the best way to do that is to start to sensationally, not up in your head, learn, yes, that's how I literally feel it tingling in my shoulders. And like an energy in my belly when I'm around this person, when I'm doing this activity, it feels like thunder and lightning in my chest. You know, you have to get real with how your body says yes to you. You have to question your thoughts. You know, you have to figure out how to say, oh, the thought, well, if you do this, you're going to end up on the street with no money. Oh, well, you can't do that. No one hires people for being lion tracking storytellers. Your mind will spit out beliefs to you. And you have to be able to realize that those beliefs that are spat out at you are not necessarily true. They're just things that you came to believe when you were young. They're just religions that you adopted along the way, sometimes because your parents said that to you, sometimes because your family had a culture of you only, if you want to do well, you have to work harder than anyone else. Whatever they are, they came in, these beliefs. No one ever got ahead if they, you know, whatever it was, trying to go their own way. So you have to be able to identify that. I would say that new things for me in the coaching space is you have to figure out what your unconscious commitments are. And we all have conscious commitments. Conscious commitments. This year I'm going to work out. I'm committed to having healthy relationships. That's what we say. The way that so those are your conscious commitments. Your unconscious commitments, the way to find out what they are is to see what results you are actually getting in your life. So if you say you want to work out, but the results are you've never been to the gym, your unconscious commitment is to not work out. If you say you want healthy relationships, but you've had five fights with five of your friends in the last month, you're still unconsciously committed to drama. And so you have to know what those things are. And finally, and I would say this is probably a big edge for me even right now, you have to realize that inside of you are different parts of you. And until you get to know those different parts, usually that were developed as a youngster, and they were developed, they're almost like parts of your psyche, they were developed to keep you safe while you were young. Until you get to know them and realize how they run the show as scared kids, they will be running your show unconsciously. So those are those, that's sort of the core of my coaching philosophy at the moment. But it's always evolving because I'm always tracking new stuff.
Beautiful, yeah. I've got a lot of different questions. Just to pick up on what you just said, because I use internal family systems and parts work in coaching.
Love.
Yeah, and what I'm curious about with you is what I found is that it's actually reveals also the thread of our lives in the sense of what you're talking about. So what I found is, often the parts that show up when a client is feeling that call into something, rather than of course Dick Schwartz says like no bad parts. So the idea is to bring self energy, bring presence to that part. But that part, once met, actually will often contain the genius or the essence of that calling. It's stunning. So, yeah.
It's to me, and I don't know if Dick what he would say about this, but watching people do it is mystical. The way when they connect with a part, and people who are not into coaching sort of go with it, and they find a part, and they allow that part to speak, and then that part starts to show them places in their lives. These like memories come, and these images come. And then, if you ask that part what it needs, it's got incredible insights. It was just never asked. And when you befriend it and let that part know that you will check in with it, because it does have great information about your unique path. And when that and then I guess I think on a deeper level too, when that part relaxes and stops needing to control in its small way, then almost naturally your beingness emerges. And the big, I mean, I guess what I would say is that the big kind of joke to me in transformational work is you're not actually trying to become something better. You're actually just allowing yourself to be yourself more. And, it's like in the pursuit of knowledge, every day something is added. In the pursuit of wisdom, every day something is dropped. It's more of a dropping. And I feel like as you get to know those parts and they relax, you just emerge. And as you emerge with more self-knowledge and with more awareness, you just know what is yours to do. And so I feel like the early phases of coaching are really practicing coaching and using the tools, different tools, using all these great tools that are that the coaching world has developed. And then, as with time, it becomes that work becomes just a knowingness of what is mine to do.
Yeah, beautiful. Do you mean by that that in a way your own consciousness takes the foreground in the way it guides the coaching? That's something I've been interested to talk to you about. So, in the beginning, maybe you're learning methods and tools, but then, actually, the most brilliant coaches I know are they don't use tools so much, or maybe they come up at points, but it's like they're following the energy, they're following
Oh,
that felt tracking.
that's so well said. I mean, Josh Waitzkin had this term from he's a master of learning things. And Josh says, form to leave form. So he says, if you become technically through training a world-class jiu-jitsu practitioner, what happens on the mat at high levels is you're not thinking about training. It's just flowing through you. And actually, you're being more creative. You've let go of the rules of how to do it because it's so in you that now you can improvise, jazz, you know? And certainly with coaching, you learn all the tools, but then you just, with time, learn to trust your own presence and to trust more of the feeling that you get sitting opposite someone or walking along and beside them. You can almost start to feel them in their body. You notice the contractions and the kinks. You feel the tone of their voice change. You hear a tightening in their throat. And all of those reeds coming together, you start to pick up on a story that they're telling regularly that is a potential constraint. All of that starts to happen unconsciously, and you realize you don't have to do anything. You know, there's not the stress of like, now I have to give a good coaching session. You're just there, present, listening, reacting, and that awareness starts to work through you. And that's so fun when you start to hit that place of just like, I'm the it's and the language breaks down when you try and talk about this stuff because it's something like, when I am deeply connected to someone in a coaching capacity, I am the most myself I've ever been, and I'm not there. You know, they sort of talk about it in acting too. For example, they say the best actors are just, they're like so present, they're not there. It's just reacting through them, like the character is reacting through them. But it's sort of, it's a place that you have to feel for.
Yeah, that's where I think something like IFS is powerful, because I think there's a tipping point when you start to, first of all, there's like the kind of like meta competency of learning to recognize parts and how to be with them by dropping the change agenda you might have. And that's just a great like meta competency to take through your life. But then equally, the more you start to integrate parts, the less they're starting to show up. And the more you can be in this space that you're talking about, which I find, and so like I found now in the coaching world, there's this big move towards coaching, which is based on the principle of unfolding rather than self-improvement. So coaches who are working with the aliveness of the moment rather than, you know, I want to get to a specific place.
You know, I didn't even realize because my mentor Martha Beck she was so there. She was there, you know, 15, 20 years ago, and I just assumed that that is what coaching was, to be being with people like that, without a sense of like, here's the coaching program. Module one is this, and module two is that. I mean, her opening line was always, "So what's going on with you?" You know, just that. Or, what's the area of least satisfaction in your life? And then it would be a jump off with the trust that like something can happen right here between us. And she also said though that if I can't really move the dials in 10 to 15 minutes, I'm off my game because when you were really present like that, actually things emerge and you can be onto them quickly if you're really listening, present. You want to be onto that limiting belief, onto that constriction, onto that blind spot. And that's tracking too. That's tracking too. And, you know, fun, like, you know, if you think about, like, I'm sure I think with people who are getting going in the coaching space, there's these challenges like the first time you put your rate up, or even the first time you set your coaching rate. And then the fear of like, oh, is this value, you know? And then you run your first retreats and you pack the schedule too much because you're so worried that everyone is going to get a good experience. And then It's kind of like when you first start doing a martial art, you overdo everything because you want to, you throw too many punches and and then you watch people at high levels. It's always relaxed. It's always calm. It's always trusting that if I'm present, the right thing will come into the space. And spaciousness actually breeds more transformation than any kind of tension. And so I really encourage coaches to trust yourself. Make space. If you're uncertain, sit quietly and longer. Allow the space to be there. Don't feel you have to fill it. Let what wants to come into it come in. Feel the other person and just stay connected. When you start running retreats and things like that, give people more time to rest. Do not be afraid of spaciousness. Let it be there. It will come. If you set the container and you're present, the processes will come almost magically.
Yeah, nice. And I'm curious for you about, we've talked about, that we can start to sense the limiting beliefs and, the ways our clients are embodying maybe something that's kind of restricting. And like there's a kind of pattern recognition, and we can really refine our perceptivity. I'm just curious for you about the other side, which is, this like tuning in. You named it earlier, that the aliveness and that the way that we feel that sense of calling inside of us. How do you track that in your clients, and how do you invite your clients to tune into that? Because I think that's a really important other side of the coin. It's like, yeah.
Well, one thing, so it, I think of it like this. If you and I went tracking together on day one, I am going to see, I'm assuming you're not a world-class tracker, but I am going to see more, I mean, animal tracker, you're a world-class human tracker, but I'm going to see more tracks than you. And that's just because I've, in this environment, been teaching myself to see specific things. And I mean, like funny things, like the funny geometry of the back of a rhino's foot. The way that when rhinos walk through the bush, they kick certain things out the way. Now, if you had never seen that before, you would see a ball of elephant dung that had been kicked over, and you would just think, oh, that's just the chaos of the wilderness. But I can see that it's been kicked over by something, and that probably means the rhino came here. The way sticks are broken, the way all these things I'm learning to see, that after a week together, you would be picking up. Because you're just developing that search image. So one of the things that I'll do with clients is I will make them describe, close their eyes and describe to me moments where they felt incredible aliveness. I want them to go back into that moment. I want them to inhabit that time. And then I want them to scan their body. So they literally start to feel like, oh, when my child was being born, when this was happening, I get this tingling. Whenever I get excited, I get this tingling in my hands. I literally feel myself slide forward in my chair. So I start to force them to slow down enough and drop in enough to categorize how their body speaks to them by going back to memories. And that's in a way teaching them to recognize what some of those feelings are. Now it can be very subtle. Sometimes when someone is more frozen, I just go for a broad feeling. Like right now, as I say to you, you've got a dinner party tomorrow with these people. Does it feel free or does it feel prison? Freedom or prison? Freedom or prison? And sometimes people will say, oh, I can't tell. I'm just numb. I'm like, okay, numb's a feeling. So feel the numbness. Let's just start wherever we are. Okay. And what I do is the same thing. You just put attention on it over 10 days. Everything you do, I want to know, freedom or shackle or prison. I want to know if it was freedom, where did you feel that? I want to know. And you know what? If you don't know, go try it and say, I went, I thought it was freedom, but then when I got there, it was shut down. And what happens is you learn it, you learn to track it. But you only learn to track it by paying attention to it, because most of us are just, patches down doing what we need to do. But if you want to get better at feeling your aliveness, you have to start tracking your aliveness every day, every moment. And notice, like, oh, I just had coffee with Janine. And as she walks off to get in her car, oh, I notice my whole body is drained. And I actually feel like I just feel like going to sleep. The life force has been sucked out of me. Okay. No judgment on Janine. I'm just starting to learn things about myself. You know, and then you could say, is that she drew, that she sucked energy off me? Or is that I said yes when I actually wanted to say no? Is that I overfilled my schedule because I've got a story that I need to make sure I give all my friends enough attention? But like noticing what's going on in the body is going to start asking secondary questions.
Yeah. So in a sense, like there's a vibrational quality to that aliveness that we can become connoisseurs of over time and start to track, you know, like maybe when it flips, you know, in subtle or larger ways.
I have this thing now with my partner, because I'm somewhat, I got into a serious relationship later in my life, and so I have a lot of hours of being by myself, and I love solitude. And so when we first got together, it was a bit bumpy because I wanted her to be happy and she wanted to do stuff together. And I would feel the moment that I had crossed my threshold, literally in aliveness, in my body, I would feel I've crossed my threshold of how much energy I have to give. I've crossed my Boyd can be social threshold. And but I'm being nice and I want her to be okay and I want to, but I was at least catching it. And then I had to get better at catching it and saying, hey, sweetheart, I'm hitting my threshold. And so either I'm gonna do this thing and go over my threshold, but then I'm gonna need to recharge later, or I'm actually gonna say to you go ahead, I've hit my threshold. I mean, it would be quite fun once you read it, learn to read it that well. And it will come up in other things too, once you start paying attention, like, hey, Boyd, do you want to come and spend time with me by the side of the lake? Full body, yes. Hey, boy, do you want to come and spend time with me? We're all going to a club tonight. Now, I want to spend time with you, but then I notice something says no. And for me, that has to do with lots of people drinking and loud spaces. So then I get to say, like, oh, as I read my aliveness and this sort of internal track compass, I'm a yes to being with you, but I'm a no to a loud space. And so now I get to say, I'm not coming with you to the club, but I would love to take a walk with you whenever you're available to that. So now we start to construct architecture around us out of that aliveness that brings more aliveness. Because when I get to the end of a walk by the lake with you, I'm 10x on energy. Whereas if I drag myself out of the club where there's been loud music and screaming, I'm a bit more drained. And playing that game with curiosity becomes a really fun thing.
And so how over time does that journey go with yourself or with your clients? So I'm imagining that they're tuned in to this feeling of aliveness, and they're kind of starting to build more awareness of like what they're drawn to, what they want. And then maybe along the way, they're meeting parts that are showing up that say you can't have that or you should. So there's that part of the journey. But like then do you invite them into, you know, spending time choosing in alignment with that choice or doing activities? And is the idea that, you know, maybe over time more and more of their lives can kind of in a sense come out of this sense of aliveness? Yeah.
Absolutely. So first we start tuning into what the aliveness actually is. As they start to get that awareness, your description is actually very right. Quite often, but it depends what type of people you're working with. I tend to work with people who have a fair amount of autonomy already. And so some of what happens is they then have to design architecture that supports that. Because they have a fair amount of freedom to move. So then I say to them, okay, well, now we need to build out structures, not a schedule. We need to know what are the things that make you feel this aliveness, that optimize you. And what's funny about it is as you start to build out that architecture of their days, their weeks, not a schedule, but these things that I have an awareness that when I do these things, I feel most alive. What's funny about it is that you would think people would leave off things like doing my taxes or, the grind type of stuff. But actually, the aliveness is so intelligent that if you're putting off something that you know is your responsibility, it starts to actually hamper you by being what's the word? Wasting time, putting things off, ignoring things starts to create a feeling of that's actually not the aliveness. So you find yourself saying, okay, in my architecture, I've done my spiritual practice, I've attended to family matters, and I've sat down and done the taxes because it actually keeps me in a feeling of this in tune with myself and aware. Now I need some downtime. Now I need some, like one of the things in my architecture is I have talking crap with my friends is part of my architecture. Like literally, there'll be a time during the week where I phone all my friends and I just have a kind of a shoot the breeze garbage session with them. But usually something creative comes out of that, and it's a way for me to move energy and hear what's going on in people's lives. But it's on the architecture. It's something I have to do that keeps me in my own flow. So you can put anything in your architecture, but you have to have enough awareness around it. Certainly, limiting beliefs have to be questioned within there. And sometimes I'll go to a part that is still running the show. Sometimes I'll go to Byron Katie work. To like write down the limiting thought, the thought that's causing stress, and then walk through it. I'm not working hard enough. Is it true? Can I absolutely know that it's true? And this is from Byron Katie's work. What happens? How do I react when I believe the thought? Here I get to know myself. I judge myself. I'm hard on myself. I waste more time than I criticize myself for wasting time. I'm thinking about what I should be doing. I can't actually fully relax. These are all the things that happen just when I believe that thought. Who would I be without the thought? I would be relaxed. I wouldn't be in this jam of you should work, but then rebelling against that voice. I would allow myself more presence. I would do what I know to do. So I go through it. I enlighten my own mind, and then finally the turnaround. I am working hard enough. My thinking is not working hard enough. I'm not working soft enough, because she makes you do these turnarounds of the thought at the end. Not working soft enough. Wow. And then as I sit in that, I can see how harsh I am on myself about how hard I can be working, how much I push, how much I forget that so much of the best things that have happened to me came out of being curious and flowing rather than rigidly lashing myself. I notice that when I think I'm the one who makes everything happen, I get a little bit in the way of the flow of life. These insights emerge. So parts work, questioning the thoughts, and once you're into that practice, things are moving.
And so then I imagine there some people find that it brings up a tension where, like, oh, I've got to schedule, it's not scheduling, but I want to kind of architect these experiences into my life, but it's full right now, of other stuff that gets in the way of that. How do I
Oh my gosh, so juicy.
that?
I mean, and it's juicy because if your life is full of a ton of things and you feel stuck, dead, and not alive, then almost certainly you have the story, I have to do this, which is a deep story. Ah, oh boy, but I do have to do it. If I wasn't doing this, my family would suffer financially. Everything would fall apart. Okay. Now, the question is, are you ready to really start to make the changes necessary to shake off that story, take up the responsibility to face all of that deep held belief and deep held evidence, and start to build a life that actually feels good to you and see what happens, including some things might blow up. But really, when we're there, we are on the junction of the work. And of course, you don't have to brass knuckle yourself. You could say, given this incredible responsibilities that I have, how do I do two things this week that start to bring in more aliveness for me? What would they be? How could I do one thing today that's a little more aliveness for my journey? And, it might be a 15-minute sip before the kids wake up. It might be coffee on the front step. But again, when you start taking small steps, given whatever circumstances you face yourself, small steps towards that aliveness, it starts to open things up. And so you can really offend your deep-held narratives and courageously blow things up and try new things, or you can bridge yourself sweetly and gently into a little more of what feels like it's for you. And I say you pick your speed, I always advocate gentleness on the self.
Yeah, beautiful. The this question is like you talked before about being in nature and how we want to know nature, but then actually you start to realize nature's knowing you. And I'm thinking here about, someone who's giving space to what brings them alive, what's calling them, and there's a kind of reciprocity in that connection. And I wonder if, this is maybe for me where the magic starts to come in, and the synchronicity, and even what life wants with me in a sense, and you talked before about being called into service, so maybe we'll get into that a bit after. But what have you seen around that? Because I've noticed it's like, yeah, if I'm in the grind mindset and I'm not feeling alive, it's like I'm disconnected from that magic. But the more I shift out of that, the more there is this kind of just joy of being alive that brings new opportunities to it.
Totally. I mean, you have such a beautiful way of saying things. I feel sometimes like maybe I should just leave it where you flung it because it's so good. But that is a, I think you're right. The big thing is that, how would I describe this? The mind seeks evidence for its beliefs. So if you have had a long-standing story proved by the way your parents treated you and everyone treated you when you were young, or something that happened when you were young, that people don't like me. Okay. And then you're walking through town and you wave at a friend or you wave at someone you know, but they don't see you. And so immediately the mind says, you see, people don't like you. Now it could have been that they didn't see you. It could have been that they didn't register who you are. It could be that they short-sighted and don't know who you are. There are a myriad of reasons, but immediately your reality becomes, you see, people don't like me. And everywhere you go, you will see that. And so until you are willing to let the mind question itself, your reality will be what you believe. And so if your deep-held belief is that the only way to make money is to be in the grind, or the only way that you can survive is by grinding, you will find that 100% of the time. I was coaching a woman once who was an army brat. I think they call them in America army brats. She had been her whole family is a military family. And she's generations make their living in the army, and she's quite unhappy in it. And I'm saying, sitting across from her, and I'm saying to her, well, she's saying, well, I mean, obviously, if I did something different, it would have to be in the army. And I'm like, well, why is that? She's like, oh, well, I've got to make a living. So I said to her, well, but can you think of anyone who's ever made a living not in the army? And she did an interesting thing. She looked up in this very particular way that I see people do when they literally their brain is myelinated neural pathways so much that that is their world. They look up with a confused look, like searching, and they get this like concentration, painful look on their face, like, oh, she's like, she couldn't get there. And I said, well, can I just draw your attention to the fact that I've never been in the army, and I make a living telling stories and tracking animals and coaching people. And literally it blew her mind, because to her, she is in that belief structure and has been her whole life. The way to make a living is the army. And so I've seen this enough in people that I really believe that we don't live in the world, we live in what we believe the world is. And until we can start to realize that that is a belief we're carrying, and that belief is creating our reality, we can't really wake up. And waking up to me is that I start to notice that my beliefs about what the world is might not be the truth. They just might be my belief. So it's very tough to listen to when you're in it. You know, the first time I heard Byron Katie ask the question, "Is it true?" I wanted to say, "Well, it's totally fucking true." You know, I mean, it's true for me that the world is a dangerous place. That has been my experience. But with time, I started to notice that when my mind opened, the world opened, and in a way that is absolutely mystical. You know, that classic thing of like when you're in a hurry, everyone's moving slowly. And when you have, like, literally, we do create the world out of our belief structures. Yeah. So that's a long way around to say, if you are willing to courageously start to question your belief, your life can change in incredible ways. If you open to the magic of saying, okay, I'm moving towards aliveness, I'm questioning my beliefs, I'm willing to take chances. And if you take that old adage of if you take one step towards the universe or God, it takes 1,000 steps towards you. Unbelievably interesting things happen. And they don't have to be big things. You can just take a small step every day. Now, if someone is sitting in front of me saying, no, I don't know about this coaching stuff. You know, it's a grind. Like, it's fine for you. You've got money. But for me, I have to grind. Then I just know that that's okay. Their mind will open when it opens or not. I'm not trying to ram anything down anyone's throat. But my experience is those who have been willing to say, like, okay, I'll just for a moment, I'll start questioning. Like, if the way I think it is 100% the truth, magic starts to happen. Like, I would say this even, and this does get quite mystical. Byron Katie's work, which if anyone's listening, you should check it out. It has been some of the most mystical work I've ever done. And it's a worksheet. Okay. Literally, it's a worksheet. But when my mind dropped a belief, really dropped a belief, my whole physical reality changed. Sometimes when a belief drops, like something that's been going on for years, something that you've known to be true, when the belief really drops, it just stops happening around you. Like literally, somehow your projection changes and it doesn't physically happen around you. I really believe we project the mind in some ways. Like she has this great saying, she says, you die and go to heaven, but you're thinking and believing what you're thinking and believing now. Where are you? If you believe that your mother should be nicer to you and that your dad should give you a house or that your spouse shouldn't be doing what they're doing, all these beliefs, or they should care more about you, all these beliefs, if you're thinking that, wherever you go, you're going to take that with you. And when you start being able to drop into reality and love what is, things start to really shift.
Yeah, teacher mindset, like reality is subjective, you know. I think it's a short way of saying what you're saying. It's like it seems like it's objective, but it's totally subjective.
Totally subjective. People say to me, the world is a cruel place. And I'll say, your world. Because, literally, everyone is having their own experience of the world. Totally, deeply. And, you watch how we project onto things. You see a homeless person, and you look at them and you tell the story of they are a suffering, they're a drug addict. They're living rough on the streets. You tell a whole story, but you don't actually know what their experience is. You have your story of their experience. And we do that to everyone we meet. I am what you believe me to be. but we don't actually know. And listen, I'm not copping out, because what I have found is that when you question the mind enough and come into that awareness, what flows out of it is a compassionate desire to be of service and take action. So it's not to say, oh, well, I actually don't believe you're suffering, so I'm going to leave you alone. It's like, I actually come to this place where I'm not putting anything, where I can ask, do you need something from me? Or I can see what is required of me in a moment. Versus just having my story and then my projection. I can actually say, what is required in this moment? And what do I know to do in this moment? And if my mind is clear and my heart is open, usually it's to step towards service and healing.
That I feel is one of the big invitations in our times as well. And I'm curious for you, your journey around that. I've personally felt stepping into the role of a coach has not, it's not just the job, it's a huge catalyst for that journey into service. And the more that I've embrace that journey through the different experiences and initiations I've had, the more potency I found my coaching has, and in a sense, like the more unique. It's like what you said earlier, like that, like you do in some sense, just like you're doing less. Like, look, you know what you said about Byron Katie's, like loving what is. The more you love what is, the more things unfold, the more uniqueness. So it's not just, it doesn't everything just get bland and passive. It's like the opposite. I'm
No,
just...
more knowing in the realms of what is yours to do. I actually say that, when what happens as you start to strip away these layers of stories and mind and become more work to love these different parts, literally energy gets integrated and the presence comes. And that presence, when people say, oh, I just want to be present, sometimes it is perceived as passive. I'm being present to you. I'm really listening to you. But to me, presence is action too. Because in a situation, I know when I'm present, I know what to do and say. It's coming through me. I'm not thinking about what I should do and say self-consciously. That's almost the difference. It's like when you're self-conscious, you're thinking, okay, I think I should say this now. Whereas when you're present, it's coming through you. If I see someone hurting a child in front of me, I take action. I'm not confused. The presence knows what to do. I step in there and I take action. And if I see someone genuinely suffering in front of me, I will step towards them with presence. So it's love acts. And what this is less things painted over that loving presence. So yeah, you articulated well. And there's less doing to it as the conduit becomes more open. And I actually learned this a lot in ceremonies when I would sit with people who were in a ceremonial space. One thing is that you go, if you want the ceremony to really go well as a facilitator, someone who's holding the space for people who are journeying or singing or whatever, any kind of ceremony, medicine, sacred plants, sweat lodge, you have to let go of the idea that of what I have to do here. The biggest thing that will stunt you is having a preconceived notion of what your role is in the space. I am here to be the teacher. I am here to make this a good sweat lodge. I am here to make this a good ceremony. That stuff is blockage. And then I am going to be a good facilitator is a blockage. I am going to move this person's process is a blockage. Because you're not really tapped into where the energy wants to be emergent and how the moment wants to come in. So the biggest thing about entering a ceremonial space was letting go of anything needing to happen, anything and getting anywhere one to any place of insight and big, I want people to leave my retreat or my ceremony with having major breakthroughs. Now you're trying too hard for that. If you, as a coach, more you're tracking. You're noticing the signs, you're following the track, and then with enough sensitivity, there might be a moment. Then the art form is actually being present for the moment when it opens up. and being able to catch it and make it spacious, and then maybe throw in a few words or a tool that opens the whole thing. But you can't try for it. You have to just trust and be there and be present. So I would say to people who are beginning their coaching journey, relax. It's going to happen. You don't have to rush it. You don't have to push it. Sit there, look into the person's eyes, notice how you feel in your body, sense into their energy, and trust it's going to happen. Ask questions and don't rush it. And if you and just get to know, ask questions, feel, give it time. It's coming. The breakthrough, the opportunity for safety and trust and presence to create an opening is coming. Relax.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah. I'm just question just bubbles up. Like, do you feel, and it's not directly related to coaching, but it's important for you to have a relationship with the divine. And if I'm just curious how that shows up for you, if so, just let me say, like, because like there's like non-dual types of spiritual practices, and then that's beautiful, but sometimes that can have a kind of like I am oneness kind of feeling. And but I've also found this kind of relationship to the divine important, and I'm just curious for you about that.
Ooh, it's a deep question. It's important for me, certainly. And I would say that for me, it's about what I would call the intelligence of life and the intelligence of the moment. Being a lover of what is, some might call that being aligned with the will of God. Like, whatever is happening, can I be at one with it? Even if it's terrible, my story is this terrible. This shouldn't be happening, but it is happening. So then, can I be with it? However, when working with clients, I don't need them to be there. I need them to be willing to look at a story, and I need them to be willing to learn to feel, breathe, and be attuned to their own aliveness and do the work of being attuned to their own aliveness with commitment. And that might be totally materialistically rational for them. I'll just say your body has in your body, you have to be willing to at least listen a little bit to what's going on in your body for whatever reason, biology. It doesn't have to be the divine. So that's like a minimum requirement for me with a client. But for me, I am in the service of what wants to happen through that intelligence in every moment. But what I've noticed, if they're willing to question their mind and they're willing to listen to their body, things start happening. I guess the other way of saying it is, St. Francis, and it's sort of we're touching on this in deep ways here. St. Francis had this saying, wherever you go, preach the gospel. Only when absolutely necessary, use words. And from a vocation point of view, I think as a coach, you have to live it to give it, to say what kind of a corny American slogan, you have to live it to give it. But what I mean by that is people have to feel when they're with you that you are a practitioner and that you have questioned deep beliefs in yourself and that you are attuned from a sensory point of view and that you're living this way. Otherwise, it doesn't work. I mean, I used to joke. I would talk to these coaches who were like, I opened this coaching practice and it's so hard and I can't get clients and it's making me so like anxious. And I'm like, okay, well, step one, this energy is not bringing any clients, And of course, I mean, it's funny and it is stressful, but like, really, your own work is your doorway to having something to offer. And like I say to people, like usually what happens is it will emerge. There's certain type of clients that it will emerge you're really good with. So you also want to learn. And I've iterated this multiple times. And I've coached founders and I've coached CEOs and I've coached people who are trying to build a culture in their business. And I've arrived at the place now where I know that if you need a coach to make you the best manager in the world, I'm not your guy. If you need a coach because you want to be the most competitive hedge fund guy in the world, I'm not your guy. I'm your guy if you are looking for a spirit guide and you want to wake up in some way. And that can be, listen, that can include business strategy. That can include, I like doing lots of different things. I think of myself as a corner man sometimes. Like I like to be adjacent to someone who's doing something really interesting, but at the core, there has to be a sense of spirit to it for me. If there's no spirit to it, I'm not really your guy. And if you aren't interested in living in a more in tune with that intelligence of life way, there's better people than me. So I also say to people, don't be afraid of finding your speed and knowing what you do. And you'll usually be really good at some things that you've done, like especially if you've been through a few transformations, if you've built a company and then let go of that identity, you'll be really great with founders who want to sell their companies. If you've had kids and then empty nested, and then you'll be really good at coaching people through that. If you've been on a journey to sobriety, you'll be good at that. So sometimes, not always, but sometimes it helps to have like reps or have been through something yourself as a, and I'm talking as a place to start.
I mean that I just feel, sorry if I cut you off there, but that like owning your dharma and your the that sense of calling,
Vocational. And I mean, when I was sitting for people a lot in ceremonial circles and I was coaching people, I was still figuring out how to make a living, but I knew that whether they paid me to do this or not, I would be doing this. This is a part of my vocation. And so that was one interesting thing. And then later I had a teacher say to me, Boyd, one of the ways to figure out what is essence in you is to notice what happens around you, wherever you go. And I did start to notice wherever I go, there'll be campfires. Wherever I go, there'll be stories. And wherever I go, usually some space will get set up in which some kind of transformational work will happen. And you could pretty much drop me anywhere. And within 14 days, I would be, that stuff would start happening. And I can't even tell you how, it just starts happening. And some of it is me saying, hey, I'm making a campfire tonight. But some of it is people saying, go see that guy. Like it just starts happening. And so that's a way that I know that campfires, storytelling, coaching, healing, that's part of my dharma.
That's a beautiful reflection, and comes back to what we were saying before about life is a mirror in a sense of, yes, we can see the limiting beliefs and how they're showing up, but also the sense of vocation and how life is just like mirroring back that back to us all the time. It's that's really I'm going to take that one with me, and it actually makes me want to ask. I know we're kind of coming towards the end of our time, but storytelling is something that I you have an incredible gift for, and I actually forgot the name of it right now, but I just listened to your most recent podcast about storytelling.
Story Hunter.
Story Hunter, thank you. And there was a beautiful way, I'm not sure I'm going to find it in my notes, but the way you were describing storytelling was just absolutely stunning to me about a way of shaping awareness. And I'm wondering for you if storytelling shows up in your coaching at all. I mean, I know because people be like, well, coaching's not for storytelling, coaching's coaching. And but I don't like those limited definitions. I'm just curious, yeah, if you if it shows up in your coaching or the importance of it in the transformational work you do.
Absolutely. I mean, I think of story hunting again as a way of living. And I think of story hunters, I have this set of principles for story hunters. The first one is be someone stories happen around. And That, whoever you are, it's a fun game to say, how do I become someone stories happen around? And usually what that means to me, it's a kind of yes energy to life. It's a yes to stepping forward towards these feelings of aliveness. And I've noticed that people who follow that end up in like really interesting lives. Story is meaning making. And I think that coaches have an important role because they are meaning makers. They help people make sense of their own journeys, where they want to go, what they want to flow out of them, how they want to express themselves. So coaches then are important as in that regard, and they're also important as story hunters to help people be find their essence, express it, go after things. And the reason I say that is because and then tell others about it. Because we live in a time that is becoming more and more mechanistic. And we live in a time where people's lives are getting more technological and by rote. And I think we need meaning makers. We need people who can set us alight with new possibilities, who can ignite us with rich ways of living, and who can express themselves and live like this. So that's why I've turned my attention to like, man, become someone stories happen around. Another one of the principles is become a character who finds characters. And what I find is that when you tap into this uniqueness and start following it and trying things, inevitably it will pull you into unusual, curious parts of life where you'll start meeting people you never could have expected to meet. And those people enrich in your lives. I think a lot about. I think we need it in these times. And so I'm saying to people, take up the mantle of coach, take up the mantle of tracker, take up the mantle of story hunter. These are the archetypes of meaning. Someone who helps other people find their purpose, someone who's willing to follow the tracks inside of them to their own purpose, and then someone who's willing to tell the story to the village about that journey. That's what I think those of us who feel that in that inner pull, you know, that you can't really explain, you just kind of know I'm meant to be a part of this. When I first met Martha Beck, she said to me, you know, Boyd, it's just weird. I feel like some of my job is to tell the people who are on the team, you're on the team. I feel like, and I went, what do you mean the team? She's like, just like people who know they're here to heal our society, our planet, ourselves. You just know it if you're a part of that. So if you're listening to this and you think you're on the team, take it from me, you're on the
Pleasant.
team.
Nice, really nice.
Yeah.
I just again the Story Hunter podcast episodes, just I mean, what I appreciate is what it started to spark in me listening to you and the journey you went on to meet the Bushmen. And I was quite surprised by how evocative and what that brought up in me. You know, I've heard you talk about the wild self, and I mean, that's what our whole, you know, conversation I think has been. I mean, I could feel something coming on online inside of me, like an adventure, you know, like the call towards adventure and story.
I just got a huge shiver on that. Yeah. So now, if something was speaking to that part that knows there's a wild adventure in me, then you don't same principle. You don't have to do it. You just switch on your awareness now, and you say, "I'm going to become someone that meaningful things happen around. I'm story hunting. I'm starting to open to what makes me want to say yes. I'm starting to attune to that. I'm going to be someone." And I mean, what's funny is that obviously everything you've built is about this. You are a storyteller for the village. Your whole platform is it's a platform to for the village of these in the world who are waking up. And so go and find more stories for those people. You know, that's part of your dharma. It wouldn't resonate with you if it weren't.
Yeah, totally, totally. I feel like there's a bit of an initiation taking place right now with this, actually. It speaks to me of our whole conversation, about fellow trackers and what being in relationship with people can evoke in terms of attuning to that sense of aliveness and what's calling you. It's like every moment is an opportunity for that voice or for that message, the intelligence that you name to kind of come
Totally.
forward.
Totally. And then to develop the skills to be able to, and you're so good at this, your articulations have been so beautiful, like be able to help language these intangible ways of being for people is really, it just helps people say like, yes, like that, I knew it, I felt it, but now those that thing, I'm a part of that. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think this is a good place to bring this to a close. And I just want to thank you, Boyd. It's been really exquisite to be together with you. And I feel plugged into my aliveness. And yeah, I just want to thank you for the work you're doing in the world. I think it's really needed. So big
Thank
thanks.
you for having me, and thank you for having me and for what you've created. And yeah, hopefully, so a lot of people will have a good time tuning into this conversation.
Yeah. And where can we find out more about your work as well?
Yes, so I actually just launched a Story Hunter course. We have another course called Track Your Life, and which are those are online courses. They're journaling courses. They're a way to promote thinking and help you go a little bit deeper with yourself. And then everything is on boydvarty.com, which is my website, podcast. You can find it all there, books, etc.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. And a reminder that the early bird enrollment is now open for our upcoming live training, The Neuroscience of Change. This program reveals the biology of change, showing us what happens in the brain and the body when different coaching techniques are used. You'll learn how to work with the innate pathways of change in all of us, so you can create powerful transformation with your clients. Just go to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. And remember, you can get the early bird discount if you join by February the 7th. Here we are, we're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com. Put your name in the sign-up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.